Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
European leaders are running out of patience with Israel's devastating war in Gaza.
For them, it's gone too far.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. While Europe may be nearing its breaking point with Israel and the Russian economy, for years it's been subjected to a massive array of economic sanctions, but they may not be working as well as some had hoped.
What happens with sanctions is that over time, people find workarounds.
And in Spain, squatters don't have to do much to make a claim on property.
Illegal occupants can just say, hey, look, our toothbrushes are in the bathroom. There's a photo of our kids hanging on the wall.
There's now an effort to make it easier to evict squatters.
Also, allegations of a Chinese spy operation in Turkey and a treasure trove of dinosaur remains in Canada today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. We begin in Turkey, where officials say they've uncovered a Chinese spy operation. It allegedly targeted members of the Uyghur ethnic minority who were originally from Xinjiang in western China and are now living in Turkey.
Human rights groups say Chinese government policies in Xinjiang rely on re-education camps, forced labor, and a suffocating security environment. But when Uyghurs from Xinjiang move abroad to places like Turkey, they say they can still be subjected to Chinese surveillance. Turkish officials say the alleged Chinese spy operation used fake cell phone towers to track people. Ragib Asoylu wrote about this for the Middle East Eye, where he's the Turkey bureau chief. We reached him earlier today in Ankara.
It's actually pretty similar to a cell phone tower that is basically in back of your car. So they use a couple of cars and they brought these devices part by part through aircraft using really commercial airliners. Because, you know, if you bring them part by part, it's really hard to detect. You can bring the antenna, you can bring the main device. They were just going to specific locations where they thought there were some Uyghur citizens. And this is working within 50 to 100 meters perimeter. So once you are close to this device, and if you have a good signal, strong signal from the device, your cell phone automatically connects to that device and basically gets every information, internet, SMS, text messages, whatever, all the data through that fake cell phone tower. So the owner of that fake cell phone tower gets all your information without any interruption.
Yeah, so the spies have to first identify the subject they want to spy on and then get within 50 to 100 meters of that subject, correct?
Yes, exactly.
So a really small cell phone tower that would fit in the trunk of your car. How long has this technology been around?
I think more than a decade. I think there has been an incident in Washington, D.C., a similar actually incident, but of course it's a more high diplomatic incident, you can guess, but this one is like more of like spying on community leaders, Uyghurs here. Like some could be really regular citizens, but as you know, Chinese government has a different perception and understanding of regular activities than us. So, you know, any small talk of criticism or demonstration planning, anything that could be perceived as a crime by the Chinese government. And we have seen in the past how they were, you know, chasing and pursuing these individuals. And I think it's really easy for them to track these people in Turkey as well, because there are specific locations and neighborhoods where the Uyghurs live in Istanbul, in Izmir and other places. So you just go there and spend some time. I think if you have the, you know, relevant personal information, it wouldn't be too hard for them to basically find out where they live and where they go. And I think that's how they did it.
What did you find out about the suspects who were running this Chinese spy network in Turkey?
Turkey is a hotbed of espionage since the Cold War, and we have similar incidents in the past from the Iranian rings to Israeli rings. Difference that you can have, these are all Chinese citizens. For example, in the Iranian and Israeli rings, you would have local people operating for the Israeli intelligence agency or the Iranian intelligence agency. But here you have seven Chinese citizens. One of them even arrived in Turkey 5 years ago, which requires really a significant amount of time and investment. And he came here, he set up shell companies, and then he learned Turkish, and then he brought the couriers one by one. And then the operation took place in March. So we are not really sure how long they've been running this operation, but for the latest arrests, they believe these people arrived in March. Maybe it didn't really take too much time for Turks to arrest them, but it's possible that they've been running this operation in the past with different personas. And this person is really looking like a highly trained spy, but the others look like, you know, really regular people. They have like different cover stories, but they don't really strike you as a really highly skilled spies. But they've been reporting back to someone called Big Boss in China and regularly passing information, personal information.
As you say, this spying op could have been going on for maybe up to 5 years.
Yes, it is very possible. But I think these people were exposed for different reasons. Maybe the Turkish intelligence had been tracking them. But the main issue initially, they were basically stealing money. They were using these cell phone towers to hack banking accounts, you know, other type of accounts to basically steal their money. So initially it looked like a regular incident, you know, a regular theft. People initially didn't think that there's nothing to do with spying. But eventually, as the investigation goes on, they understood that they basically self-funded themselves. They were, you know, refunding their operation on the ground in Turkey as well, because it's not very cheap to use cars, you know, arrange these flights. So it's really brilliant, very sophisticated plan.
I was just about to ask you, you mentioned the spying on Uyghurs from Xinjiang in China who are residents, current residents of Turkey. Were they spying on other people?
Yes, the Turkish officials say they've been spying on Turkish officials who have been in touch with the Uyghurs. Turkey and the Uyghur Turks have a cultural relationship, you know, we consider them as fellow Turkish citizens. Some of them have Turkish passports, some of them don't. They have permanent residency. And of course, they are frequently in touch with other Turkish officials over here. Regular consultations, I would believe, depending on the person. So they were also spying on those Turkish citizens to understand what kind of relationship they have, what kind of support Turkey was providing to them. This has been a long simmering tension between Turkey and China, actually, for a decade. Turkish foreign minister visited China and visited Uyghur autonomous zone, and they kind of tried to let this go to basically correct the relationship. But the spying on Turkish officials indicate that, you know, the Chinese still have some concerns on the relationship that Turkey has with the Uyghur citizens over there.
Ragib Soylu is the Turkey bureau chief at Middle East Eye. He spoke with us from Ankara.
Across much of Europe, the idea that housing is a basic human right is widely accepted. It helps explain why many European governments have tolerated squatters, people living in empty buildings or even houses without paying rent. Spain has taken a particularly lax approach to enforcing property laws, and that's allowed squatting to flourish for several decades now. But a new law aims to put a stop to it, as we hear from the world's Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Imagine coming home from an extended trip to find someone else living in your apartment. This scenario unfolds several thousand times a year in Spain. Police can stop squatters if they catch them in the act of breaking in. But if the squatters get inside unnoticed and change the locks, you're in big trouble.
Es hasta que el que ha entrado puede demostrar que esa es su casa.
Once squatters establish residency in your place, says Xavier Ruiz, you can't get them out. Ruiz is a self-taught expert on squatting. It's as easy as ordering a pizza or something off Amazon, he says. For the police, the receipt with the squatter's name on it, along with your address, that's proof enough that they live there. Or illegal occupants can just say, hey, look, our toothbrushes are in the bathroom. There's a photo of our kids hanging on the wall. Under Spanish law, Ruiz says, that's enough to gain instant protection from being evicted. Ruiz knows all about squatter's tricks, not because he is one. He's had them. Just last week, he managed to get a squatter out of a flat he owns about 2 hours from Barcelona. It was a young woman with a dog, he says. She had a job and could have paid rent somewhere, but I ended up paying her to move out. To the tune of over $3,000. He could have taken her to court, but in Spain, it can take years just to get before a judge. Courts are simply overwhelmed. But Spain has a new law meant to make evictions easier. It's known popularly as Evictions Express. It lets property owners fast-track their cases and get most squatters out within 15 days, in theory.
En la práctica no está siendo un desahucio express en la mayoría de los casos.
But as this judge in Madrid, María Jesús del Barco, told Spanish TV, in practice, the law isn't working. It's not just the backlog of cases, she says, but also the protests. When the authorities show up to evict somebody, they often call it off because they find huge crowds protesting. They're protesting Spain's huge housing problem. Demand has far outstripped supply in recent years, sending rental prices through the roof and squatters through locked doors and shuttered windows. I swing by one squat in Barcelona, end up chatting inside with a young woman who prefers not to give her name. She says she and some friends broke into this boarded-up, city-owned building 8 years ago.
El alquiler en Barcelona es inmoral.
Rental prices in Barcelona, she says, they're so high, it's immoral. Plus, she says, groups of foreign investors with tons of money have been buying up lots of flats, pushing prices even higher, and no one, she says, is stopping them. For thousands of people, she says, it's squat or sleep outside. As for local owners, the situation makes some of them reluctant to rent at all. One reason, there's a class of squatters that the new Eviction Express law does not cover. Inquiocupas, they're called in Spanish, or renters who sign a long-term lease, then just stop paying.
Y puedes estar así, pues años, dos, tres años, sin cobrar absolutamente nada.
You could be stuck for the next 2 or 3 years, says local businesswoman Lluïsa Ripoll, without charging a dime. But as the owner of the occupied flat, you still have to pay property taxes and utility bills. Ripoll just bought an apartment in downtown Barcelona. It'd fetch a high price in today's market, but she says she's not willing to take the risk.
En la realidad, no está funcionando. Cuando se fueron, yo no sé si tenían llaves, no tenían.
The Evictions Express law is not working, says apartment owner Xavier Ruiz. When my squatter left, he says, I was scared. I didn't know who else might have keys. So I put in an entirely new security door, changed the locks, and got an alarm. Hardly a perfect solution, but Ruiz isn't discouraged. In fact, he started a business buying apartments with squatters inside. They're like half the market price. Then, as he did with his own flat, he pays the squatters to leave, fixes the places up, and sells them. The only squats he won't touch, he says, those where people are on the edge, maybe one step from homelessness, struggling families with young kids, for example.
El tema de vivienda social, que es donde pueden ir las personas vulnerables.
The country should be building more subsidized housing for the most vulnerable, he says, but it isn't doing it fast enough. The current government says it has built some 80,000 subsidized apartments and has pledged 100,000 more, but it's far short of what Spain needs. So the tension remains. Homeowners are still stuck with squatters who have few other options. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
So anyone who's ever driven on a highway will probably recognize this.
The rumble strip.
Yep, a rude awakening, but that is kind of the point, an important safety measure. The concept, though, behind it, tires going over asphalt grooves at a certain speed, creating sonic vibrations, it's being adapted for a new musical highway in Turkey. If you're moving at around 60 miles per hour, you'll hear Mozart's Sonata No. 11.
Also known as the Turkish March or Rondo a la Turca, asphalt is probably not the best medium for a Mozart sonata. It might be easier to recognize Rondo a la Turca played on musical instruments.
The Mozart-playing road in question, the Nalahan-Beypazarı State Highway in Ankara, was just completed, but it's hardly the first of its kind. Denmark got a musical road in 1995 to a lot of fanfare, despite not sounding like much. Listen closely, or you could miss it.
Yeah, easy to miss the music there. In 2008, Honda made a commercial based on the idea.
We're thinking of the wind tail overture. We've been able to calculate the spectrum of spacings that we need for all of the different notes in our song. Let's drive this thing and see what it sounds like.
¶¶ Musical highways already exist in Japan, South Korea, and in New Mexico and California here in the U.S.
But the Turkish march in Turkey? Extra credit for cleverness.
You're with The World.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank today, a delegation from the European Union visited the Palestinian city of Jenin. And suddenly, Israeli soldiers nearby fired warning shots in their vicinity. A video shared on social media shows the delegates scrambling for cover. The EU's top diplomat condemned the incident, calling it unacceptable. The Israeli military said warning shots were fired when the delegation deviated from its approved route. The episode underscores the strained relationship between Europe and Israel. For example, Britain suspended trade talks this week. EU officials have said they're reviewing commercial ties with Israel. Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland has been watching developments closely from London. I spoke with him earlier and asked why the EU is conducting this review.
Israel has a trade association agreement with the 27 member states of the European Union by which it gets preferential treatment, including that tariffs that might apply to exports from other countries do not apply to Israeli exports. There is, for example, participation allowed to Israeli scientists in the European Horizon program. This is privileged access to what is the largest single market in the world, the European Union. And it's been profitable for Israel and for Israeli businesses. And that is now, at least the threat, is that that will be under review. 17 of the EU's 27 member states have voted to re-examine the legal basis of that agreement. In other words, considering the whole thing. And then there are just other proposals that are out there, whether it's different countries proposing sanctions, others talking about, you know, action they would take to identify and sanction specific Israelis, meaning, for example, Israeli settlers and leaders of that kind. So it's a whole diplomatic array of measures that would just generally make life harder for Israel in its relationship with the continent that is right there.
Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I understand that for the EU to actually suspend ties with Israel, that would require unanimity in the bloc. You just said there were only 17 countries that voted for that. So is there much bite potentially behind this, or is it all bark?
No, there is bite, because you're quite right that it would have to be a consensus in order to cancel that EU-Israel association agreement. But a qualified majority could suspend parts of that agreement. So 17 members, that's a big number. They could get together and organize quite a lot, which would make life harder for Israel.
I want to play some comments from British Foreign Secretary David Lammy. He was speaking in Parliament about the war in Gaza here.
What is happening is morally wrong, unjustifiable, and it needs to stop.
That is pretty pointed criticism you can hear there. Does this moment, based on everything we've talked about so far, seem to be a tipping point in Europe?
I think it does seem that way. You're absolutely right to say that just the tone, Lammy capturing there the sentiment of a lot of European governments, which is just a frustration and anger, even I would say revulsion at some of the images coming out from Gaza, very specifically tied to hunger. The humanitarian crisis is what has pushed things to this moment. Now, there may be many who look at the death toll, way over 50,000, according to the Hamas-controlled health ministry in Gaza, and say, why wasn't it the constant aerial bombardment of Gaza that brought this level of outrage? There has been an extraordinary level of understanding extended to Israel in the 18 months since October the 7th, about the military offensive. It's understood, and a great benefit of the doubt has been extended to Israel, that when it says we've bombed this or that building because there was a Hamas commander or command center underneath the school or hospital or apparently civilian target, European governments have more or less accepted that, or at least given the benefit of the doubt, despite a lot of public pressure from their own electorates against that. This, they cannot in any way begin to defend the use of starvation as a weapon to pressure Hamas, because there's no targeting of Hamas. It is, by definition, indiscriminate, affecting the blanket population of Gaza. And that ministers, policymakers in European capitals have found themselves without any kind of argument that they can marshal to defend.
Israeli leaders are saying, I think, that starvation is not actually a problem in Gaza, although there is strong evidence to the contrary. Is that still the line?
That has been the line. Even though Israeli officials say, you know, that there is no shortage, the problem is their own words. So you have Israel's defense minister, Yisrael Katz, saying explicitly, we are going to ensure no aid gets into Gaza because we think that is one of the strongest levers of pressure on Hamas. So it's there in Israeli officials' own words, and that partly means there's really no place to hide as European fury rises. These are people who've taken a lot of heat over the last 18 months for not coming too hard on Israel. And yet, for them, it's gone too far.
So we've spoken a lot about opposition to what Israel is doing right now. But does Israel still have strong supporters in Europe? I'm thinking of Germany and Italy and Greece, big historic supporters.
That's right. Those countries did take Israel's side. Germany has historic reasons why it is always wants to be the last country to condemn Israel because of the record of the Holocaust. And then you have governments associated with the right. Giorgia Meloni is obviously the Prime Minister of Italy, is a rightist figure. You have Viktor Orban in Hungary, who often take pleasure in defying the international institutions and embracing Israel. And so they're there at the moment. But it's very noticeable, I think, that the others so far are not. And there will be pressure. I think we'll see, you know, the public opinion in Germany and in Italy heading the same way, because now, in some ways, a taboo has been broken when you have the likes of Canada and France and the United Kingdom. And I would say they are still allies. They're just not sympathetic to this ultra-nationalist government of Netanyahu's.
Jonathan Friedland is a columnist with The Guardian in London. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The European Union and the United Kingdom are slapping new sanctions on Russia. They mostly target Russia's covert oil exports and are intended to pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin to take part in peace talks with Ukraine after he refused to commit to a 30-day ceasefire in his war there. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports that Russia's economy so far has withstood Western sanctions, but it is not immune to economic pressure.
In Europe, the EU's stance on Russia is clear. As long as it keeps attacking Ukraine, and as long as it's unwilling to negotiate a ceasefire, European countries will increase sanctions against Russia. Here's EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas speaking yesterday in Brussels.
Instead of seeking peace, Russia is still playing games. And Russia has escalated its attacks. The only option is to put more pressure on Russia to negotiate seriously.
In the U.S., the Trump administration has taken a different approach. On Monday, a reporter asked President Trump why he hasn't increased sanctions on Russia.
Well, because I think there's a chance of getting something done. And if you do that, you can also make it much worse. But there could be a time when that's going to happen.
After Trump's phone call with Putin, many of Ukraine's supporters criticized the U.S. for being soft on the Kremlin and for losing leverage in negotiations by offering concessions without applying extra pressure. Yesterday, during a hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Secretary of State Marco Rubio defended Trump's negotiating tactics.
Not one sanction has been lifted on the Russians. Every single sanction that was in place under the previous administration remains in place. So this idea we've given up leverage, well, the only leverage we have the same leverage today we had under the previous administration.
But Russia's been targeted with robust sanctions since 2014. So what can additional sanctions achieve? Rachel Ziemba, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, says one of the keys to answering that question is understanding the state of Russia's economy.
Russia's economy has been stagnating, has been weakening. The fiscal deficits have been growing. The costs of war are racking up. Oil prices are down year on year. So Russia's revenues have been declining.
Ziemba says that for years, Russia has attempted to diversify its economy. However, the war in Ukraine changed the Kremlin's priorities.
This has become a war economy. The consolidation of the economy around the government, around the military, it continues to grow. And that means that the private sector sources of revenue for the government, this is all contracting.
Elina Rybakova is a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington. She says that the saving grace for Russia's economy is its natural resources.
Russia is endowed with important natural resources that we're all still willing to consume. That's oil, gas, fertilizers, metals and mining, rare earth materials. And it takes an outstanding amount of mismanagement and stupidity to be able not to benefit from these resources.
So when it comes to sanctions, Rybakova says there's a limit for what they can accomplish.
The expectation that sanctions will change regimes, bring back unicorns, and do many other things, that is absolutely unrealistic, and it was very unrealistic from the beginning. What sanctions can do, they can make some things more costly, and therefore sort of throw sand in the wheels of Russian military-industrial complex, the militarized economy.
But despite the tough talk, Rachel Ziemba says the EU has been unwilling to fully cut off Russian oil and gas imports.
The West decided that the world couldn't do without Russia's oil in the near term, and their focus was to pay them less for those resources rather than to choke them off in total. So that means that the sanctions pressure as a result is incomplete.
Since 2022, G7 countries set a price cap on Russian crude oil at $60 a barrel. The idea was to cut into Russia's oil revenues while keeping it on the market. Russia has also built up a shadow fleet of oil tankers that continue to export Russian oil across the globe, undermining the price cap. The most recent EU sanctions target some of the vessels in Russia's shadow fleet, but Elina Rybakova says that's not enough.
Russia finds new circumvention ways, and then Europeans realize that they need to sanction more companies, go after shadow fleet. So to stay in place, you need to keep on running.
In recent days, Ukraine has called on the G7 to lower the oil price cap and enforce it. For now, the Trump administration has threatened the use of sanctions, but it's yet to show a willingness to follow through on those threats. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
In the past several days, the lives of two young influencers in Latin America were brought to a violent end. In Mexico, an influencer named Valeria Marquez was shot while live streaming on TikTok at her beauty salon. And a model from Colombia, Maria Jose Estupian, was murdered just days after winning a domestic violence court case. Authorities are investigating both cases as possible acts of femicide. That's when women or girls are killed because of their gender. Paula Avila Guillen is a Colombian lawyer and activist and described Estupian's background.
She was already struggling with domestic violence. And the reason why this is important is because we have seen the data that highlights the majority of aggressors when it comes to femicide don't start just as one-time offenders jumping from zero to homicide, but they usually have some incidents of violence against women prior to actually the incident of the homicide. So the fact that she already had a criminal complaint against an aggressor because of domestic violence, I think there is no coincidence.
Can you tell me about any similarities you see between her case and what happened to Valeria Marquez in Guadalajara, whose case also made headlines in recent weeks?
Both of them were influencers. A lot of what they did for a living was communicate with the public. And there is enough data also to show us and tell us that especially when it comes to women who are influencers, the public can be really aggressive, especially men that are online. They tend to believe that these influencers belong to them, mm-hmm. right?
Based on what you know, do you think that both of these cases fit the description of femicide as it is legally defined in countries like Mexico and Colombia?
It's hard to get to this conclusion so quickly, but I do think that for the preliminary information that we have, they do. In the case of the Colombian influencer, it was clear that there was a pattern of domestic violence before in her life. And in the case of the Mexican influencer, there are reasons to believe that it was connected to the fact that she is a woman. So that's kind of the definition of femicide, that in the intention of killing, the motivation behind is related to the gender of the person and to the fact that they are women.
Are we seeing more cases of femicide lately or fewer? Is this problem growing or getting better?
It's actually very stable, and that's not necessarily a good thing because it remains really high, right? We did see the big jump in general during the pandemic of domestic violence, of violence against women in general, of a femicide, and they have been stable in the high since then.
Mm. You've spoken a bit about how these two influencers' jobs, you know, might have put them at risk because they're so in the public eye. Can you speak more broadly about what kind of role social media plays in cases of femicide?
Women who decide to have a public figure, right, that they are on social media transmitting their voice or that they are on the press, are victims of higher levels of harassment and violence online. From politicians to influencers to media stars, there is this idea that people online tends to be way more aggressive when it comes towards women. And of course, the level of violence that goes in the comments that we see online is really, really high when it comes to women. When the culture believes that women don't have control over who we are, but we belong to somebody else, right? That they can own us. We tend to be more victims of violence. So there is a culture that exists that send a message that, you know, we belong to men.
How big of a problem is femicide in Latin America versus other regions?
It's actually really high. And that's one of the reasons why the majority of countries in Latin America have laws against femicide. And this is the result, the direct result of having suffered of a big epidemic of femicide. Now, having the laws in place was one of our biggest battles as advocates for women's rights, which is great. But now we need to go the next step. And the next step is to try to change the cultures and also make sure that there is accountability and proper investigation of these cases as feminicide cases.
You mentioned the need to change culture. On a surface level, at least, gender equality seems to be improving in some Latin American countries. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum recently became the country's first female head of state. There are now several female governors heading important Mexican provinces. Women hold nearly 30% of congressional seats in Colombia. Are these women in leadership positions in a position to be able to improve the trend lines here on femicide in Latin America?
Definitely is one of the first steps. We also have seen how we have changed abortion laws in Argentina, in Mexico, and Colombia to be more progressive, right? We free all the women who were imprisoned in El Salvador because of obstetric emergency. So I do think that there is an advancement, but at the same time, you are seeing narratives and people in position of power saying the women should stay at home, the women should not be able to be as active, the women a second-class citizen. So I think that we are in a very crucial moment where we have seen progress, but if we don't double down in the progress, we are probably facing a possible backlash.
Colombian lawyer and activist Paula Avila Guillen directs the Women's Equality Center in New York. Raffles are a dime a dozen, but rarely is the prize a house.
Hi, my name is Imelda, and I'm offering you this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to win my stunning home situated on 1.75 acres in magnificent County Leitrim, Ireland.
To be clear, this is not a raffle for a cause. Imelda Collins is just a regular person working with a raffle company to sell her own house. It's located outside the coastal city of Sligo in Northern Ireland, where two-bedroom homes go for about $300,000 max.
If she sells all the tickets, she hopes to net around $450,000. And someone gets a fully furnished home for less than $7.
A wonderful feature of the property is that it benefits from a south-facing position, ensuring sunshine from sunrise to sunset.
One caveat, though, and it's a biggie, 150,000 tickets must be sold or no prize will be given. Sounds like a no-risk bet for Imelda, less so for those ticket buyers. People across Europe are worried about the durability of democracy. They see the rise of the far right across the continent, not to mention democratic norms that are being shredded on this side of the pond, as signs that pluralistic government is taking a beating. One group of European citizens is looking back to ancient Greece for inspiration. A new crowd-funded campaign called Democratic Odyssey wants to tackle this question: how can we, the people, help steer the European ship through stormy seas ahead? From DW, Deutsche Welle, Zoe Bass reports.
It's been over 2,300 years since the last Citizens' Assembly took place on this plateau opposite the Parthenon in ancient Athens. This form of deliberative democracy is based on the idea that ordinary citizens can and should play a central role in finding solutions to some of society's toughest problems. Debate, theatre, and music were all used to explore ideas and make connections. Building on the Conference on the Future of Europe, this crowdfunded initiative calls for radical political change. The goal? A permanent standing People's Assembly for Europe.
And so a People's Assembly for Europe is, at least in part, about trying to influence and shape the agenda of the next European Commission and European Union.
That was Niccolò Milanese, founder of European Alternatives, speaking at the opening of the Assembly in Athens. So how does one get involved in something like this? Candidates are selected by a process of sortition, using lottery draws, dice rolls, or by simply approaching people in person, on the street or in the park. I asked some of those who participated about their initial expectations.
Honestly, I have never participated in this kind of program before. And I was really curious about how it will be organized and what kind of people I would meet there.
Vicky lives in the Czech Republic, but is originally from Belarus, where she worked as a journalist. Emil, who is Finnish but now lives in Estonia, has previous experience with a smaller, locally based citizens' assembly.
Honestly, I was a bit skeptical at first, because doing something like this, something so widespread like this, and then trying to bring those suggestions and ideas to a practical level, it can be very difficult.
For Emil, the discussions of past and future crises highlighted the differences in perspective of Eastern and Western Europe.
At the assembly, we were talking about the crises, and I think it became more clear that the people, the ones who live in Athens or Greece, or then in the Western part of Europe, they don't see the war in Ukraine in the same way that the Eastern part does.
And I do believe that the main way people can help steer the European ship through upcoming storms is by realizing that the ship is not European.
Nikki from Nigeria, born in Greece.
Because this assembly that I experienced in Athens was not European. There were so many communities from different backgrounds and different starting points. And despite the gap, they figured out ways to talk to each other, to connect to some degree.
And Anthe, a law student from Athens, drew on the wisdom of an ancient Greek philosopher for inspiration.
Aristoteles said that all of us, even if we are not expert politicians, we have something tiny little thing to offer to make democracy works better. So I think the solution is to stay connected and share our opinions and our concerns about the future of democracy, because that's the whole point of the democracy. All the voices must be heard.
And that's the point. The ideas and recommendations of these citizens will need to be taken seriously by those in power if real change is to follow. Yet former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, speaking at the Athens Assembly, is hopeful.
It'll be a fight because not everybody will like this. Some people don't want power to the people. I will be with you. I will be supporting because I am now in the Council of Europe. It's 46 countries. We already just made a report on participative democracy and actually mentioned the Democratic Odyssey and what you are doing here. So I think we will slowly be able to reach a more permanent citizens' assembly for all of Europe.
It is difficult to foresee how this particular odyssey will end, but the hope and enthusiasm of all of those to whom I spoke for this report was undeniable. All told me they will continue to participate, either via the online assemblies or in person.
That's Zoe Bass reporting for our partners DW Deutsche Welle. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the northern part of the Canadian province of Alberta, paleontologists are working their way through a mass dinosaur graveyard. Under layers and layers of soil, rock, and dust, in a football field-sized site, are the bones of 10,000 Pachyrhinosaurus, a dinosaur species that was endemic to the region. Paleontologists now think these beasts were migrating together in a herd when catastrophe struck. Emily Bamforth is the paleontologist leading the dig at the Pipestone Creek bone bed. She's also curator of the Philip J. Currie Dinosaur Museum in nearby Wembley, Alberta.
So the Pachyrhinosaurus was one of the horned dinosaurs. So it's a smaller, older cousin of the Triceratops. But instead of having a horn on its nose like a Triceratops had, they have this huge bony mass that we call a boss. And that's something that no other dinosaur really had. That's sort of what makes them unique. So they're sort of a medium-sized horned dinosaur, roughly the size of an Indian elephant, about 12 feet long, weighing about 2 tons or so. So a fairly sizable animal.
And like the Triceratops, kind of like plates on its body?
It would have had scales like a reptile. Okay. It would have had a shield on the back of its head like a Triceratops would have. And at the edge of the head shield, there would have been horns that sort of curled over the edges.
So the evidence of all these remains in the same area does suggest catastrophe. But what about this site convinces you that this was a herd of Pachyrhinosaurus that was killed instantaneously?
So they are all deposited in the same layer of rock, and all of the bone is jumbled up together. It's basically like a big Pachyrhinosaurus omelet. So the nature of the deposit itself, the fact that all of the bones are very, very well preserved, and that there's no variation in terms of the preservation grade, suggests that these animals all died at the same time and all got buried in a single event.
And are you finding evidence of Pachyrhinosaurus of all ages and sizes in this site?
Yes, so that's the other really neat thing about the Pipestone Creek bone bed, is we think this is a community of dinosaurs. So we find adults, we find babies, we find juveniles, we find the subadults. We basically have the entire age range, the entire growth series of this animal preserved.
So determining what caused this mass death of dinosaurs 72 million years ago, that's a mind bender in and of itself. Where is the evidence leading you so far?
Our theory about how these animals died was that they died in a catastrophic flood. And our evidence for that comes from partly the modern world. Events that kill large numbers of herding animals today tend to be things like flood. If you think about things like caribou or wildebeest, you can have events where a large proportion of a herd can be wiped out by a flooding event. So that's why we believe the Pachyrhinosaurus died in a flooding event. The other evidence is the environment that these animals were living in. So back 72 million years ago when these animals were alive, back in the Cretaceous period, they were living between the Rocky Mountains, which already existed back then, and what we call the Western Interior Sea, which was an inland sea that basically cut North America in half from the Arctic Circle to the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow.
And so they lived in this sort of coastal lowland. So an event like a hurricane or like a monsoon event from the ocean could have come in and inundated this area with water. There could potentially also have been a storm event in the mountains that sent a lot of water running down the mountains towards the seaway. So there's a lot of potential for flash floods in this particular environment.
So if we look at floods in the modern world, we often see a connection to climate. So what was the climate like in this part of Canada 72 million years ago? Do we know?
We do, based on the plant fossil record, actually. So the plants give us a good indication of what the world was like. So we believe that this was a much warmer world back then, kind of a mean annual temperature of around 14 degrees Celsius.
14 Celsius is 57 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately.
So much, much warmer than it is today. And there would have been almost no, maybe a little bit of freezing in kind of the equivalent of winter, but not too much. It would have been much wetter, so about six times wetter than it is today, and heavily forested. So these areas would have been covered with these lush forests made up primarily of giant redwood trees. So a very different world than we have here today.
So the Pipestone Creek bone bed where you are, I understand, was discovered in the 1970s by accident. Tell us more about how that happened.
Yeah, so the Pipestone Creek bone bed was initially found by a high school science teacher from the nearby city of Grand Prairie who was hiking down the creek. This was 1972, and he came across the first bones in the creek bed below what is now the bone bed. He took those bones, he followed them up the hill, and he was able to find the bone deposit in the ground. And the species is actually called Pachyrhinosaurus lacustae, is named after him. His name was Al Lacusta.
Oh, interesting.
And so he basically initially found the bone bed deposit.
And how long have you and your team been digging there?
Our museum started the excavations in 2015, and we go there every single year and collect usually between 500 and 700 bones every year.
How rich of a source of information about dinosaurs is this bone bed proving to be?
So this bone bed is paleontological gold because it represents a single community of a single species of dinosaur from a snapshot in time. And it's a huge sample size. So the fact that we have animals of all ages, we potentially have a fossilized community. So we can tell things like community structure, about growth of the animals, like how they go from being babies to adults. We can tell things like parental care. These are all questions that we can ask when we have such a deposit that can very, very rarely be asked in the fossil record.
So clarify something for me, Emily, because I just read that our current knowledge of nearly half of all known dinosaurs is extrapolated from just a single specimen. So are we saying that this suddenly doubles what we could potentially know about dinosaurs?
Potentially, yes. One of the big mysteries about dinosaur paleontology is what makes one individual in a species different from another individual in a species, because so many species are just known from one specimen or a handful of specimens. So at a place like Pipestone Creek, where we have hundreds of individuals, we have a good understanding of like what makes this individual in the species different from another individual. And so that really helps us understand what is a species in the fossil record. Like, how unique does a specimen have to be called a new species?
So in this site with paleo gold, as you call it, what are the questions you really want answered?
We're really interested in what's called individual variation within a species. And so, again, that idea of like what makes one individual different from another. So a good example is in the frills of these animals. So kind of the head shield on the back of the head, they have these horns. And at Pipestone Creek, no two individual has exactly the same horn arrangement. But those arrangements of horns are often used to define new species of horned dinosaur. So now this is calling into question how valid is that character in defining a new species if every individual in the same species could have a kind of different frill ornamentation. So those are the kind of things that we're really trying to dig into a little more.
Emily, what really gets you excited about this work?
I absolutely love the thrill of discovery. Being a paleontologist isn't just digging up dinosaurs. There's a whole lot more to it. But I love the field work, going out and finding things. And just, you know, it's so thrilling to find a new thing in the ground, to know that that new thing has such potential to tell us about ancient world, about dinosaurs, about the world as it existed before we were here. So that's my favorite part, is the thrill of discovery.
Emily Bamforth is the lead paleontologist on the dig at the Pipestone Creek bone bed. She's also curator of the Philip J. Currie Dinosaur Museum in Wembley, Alberta.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks as always for being here. We'll see you all again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
by the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillianne Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.